Welcome back to the War Room at American Bridge podcast. I'm David Brock, co-founder of American Bridge 21st Century. Today, it's a pleasure to be joined by Mark Elias. Mark is the chair of the political law department at Perkins Coie, and in both 2004 and 2016, he served as general counsel to the Democratic presidential nominees, John Kerry and Hillary Clinton. He also represents and advises numerous leading Democratic groups and campaigns, including the Democratic National Committee, the DCCC, the DSCC, and the Senate and House Majority PACs. He's also argued and won 4 cases in the U.S. Supreme Court, and Politico named him as one of 50 in politics to watch. Mark, thanks for joining us today in the War Room.
Happy to be here.
Great. So just a few weeks ago, the New Republic published a piece about you under the headline, "The Man Who Is Determined to Stop Trump from Rigging the Election." So for my first question, and it may be a long answer, but as someone who's at the ground zero for all this important voting rights litigation, tell me what worries you the most about what's going on or what may happen, and then I'll tell you what worries me the most. You go first.
So, I get paid to worry about everything. So the real question is, what don't I worry about? I think if you ask me what I worry most about, it is that what we have seen from Donald Trump over the course of the last 4 years, really from before he was elected, is someone who will do anything and say anything and will do anything or say anything that undermines democratic institutions and norms. And so a lot of our election systems rely not just on rules and laws, but on candidates and campaigns acting a certain way within those laws and rules. And so what worries me the most is that he and his campaign, even if it becomes abundantly clear that he has lost the election, will act as if he didn't. And that won't change the outcome, right? It won't lead to a different result. Right. But what it will do is undermine people's confidence in the election at a time when normally we expect candidates coming together. I'll tell you one sort of anecdote to illustrate this. You know, I was in the hotel suite area when it became clear that Secretary Clinton was not going to win, and I don't pretend that I was, you know, at the center of those conversations, but I was privy enough to them to know that it never occurred to anyone to say, "Hey, why don't we go out to the Javits Center and say we won?" Right? Like it never occurred to us to say, you know, maybe we did win. So that's part of what worries me.
Yeah, that makes sense. So mine is a little more less macro, a little more specific. It's this issue of the RNC unleashing these, I'll call them thugs, to quote monitor the elections at the polls, because I think for about decades, 40 years or so, these types of intimidation tactics weren't permitted. But a court decision a couple of years ago changed that. So this is the first cycle we're going to encounter these types of tactics. And my question is, should we be worried about that? And is there a way to guard against that?
We should. We should, for sure. And David, I think you, if you're going to focus on the macro, on the micro or on the individual, I think you picked the right one. And I want to emphasize something you said, which is for the first time in our lifetimes. I mean, people think, well, you know, doesn't that just mean 2020 will be sort of 2016 plus Trump? And the answer is no, because in 2016, the Republican National Committee was still under this prohibition.
Right.
You have to go back to 1980 to find a presidential election where the RNC was not under that that prohibition. So I do worry that, Trump has said that they're going to recruit 50,000 poll watchers. We all know that they're not showing up at the polls just to watch, right? And I do worry about that. And we've already seen some anecdotal evidence of disruptions by Trump and Republican people. So, right. Yeah, I do worry about it. And it's something that, you know, I know all of the campaigns in the Democratic Party are planning for, to make sure that, you know, we have a process in place to counteract that. And I know the states and the localities do as well.
Right. Okay. Well, let's hope so there. So let me ask you one big picture question before we get into some of the litigation, which is basically what I want to know is how did we get here to a point where both sides are spending tens of millions of dollars to fight over voting rights in the courts? And you know, the reason I ask the question is I think it's important that people realize, and I think you'll agree with me, it's not just Trump. There's been a years-long campaign by the right to suppress the vote. There's such a thing, actually, as anti-voting rights conservatives. You have Republican electeds, and then, you know, backed up by what I've called the Republican noise machine. So could you talk a little bit about that context in which this is all playing out?
Yeah. So I've been asked, you know, how do I think we got here from a timeline standpoint? And I normally put it at the election of President Obama in 2008. And the Republican Party and the conservative movement facing a existential question of whether they tried to compete for or tried to suppress the emerging electorate. And right. You saw that in 2012 and then in the autopsy report following the 2012 election. And Trump has represented the all-in with voter suppression as their tactic. And with that has come a huge infrastructure. You know, I'm oftentimes asked about the fact that the RNC has said it will spend $20 million in court fighting against voting rights. But I also usually point people to the AP story that shows that Republican conservative dark money groups are spending up to another $100 million. You know, the Honest yeah. Elections Project is one of them. It was founded by the same person who founded the Federalist Society. And so there's a lot of money and effort and energy going in on the right to opposing voting rights. And it's a very, very different landscape than we saw, you know, 10 years ago, where there were certainly disagreements between the parties, significant disagreements over voting rights, but both sides sort of stood up, at least mouthed the principles of voting rights. Now on the right, they are unabashed about what they're doing.
Right. Absolutely. So is the volume of litigation that you're involved in this year, is that normal or is there something new and unusual about 2020?
Oh my God. I think, you know, at one point I made the mistake of telling a reporter that there was more litigation in 2020 than there was in 2018 and 2016 combined.
Wow.
I would say that it is probably more like there's been more litigation in 2020 than 2018, 2016, 2014, 2012, 2010, 2008 combined. And even with that, I don't mean to limit 2006, 2004. I mean, it's just, it is an explosion of litigation because, and you know this, David, as someone who's been involved in the media, the media's main tool over politicians is shame. It is the ability to ask them a hard question and make them stand up in public and defend something that causes them embarrassment to defend. This administration has no shame. The current Republican Party has no shame. So they're willing to stand up and say, hey, we should ban drop boxes. I mean, literally, who in their right mind in the middle of a pandemic comes out against ballot drop boxes? Right. But that is the stated position of the Republican Party and the president and his Republican and conservative allies.
Right. Absolutely. So basically, they don't think they can win a fair fight is what we're talking about here. And that's what's underneath this.
Oh, I don't think there's any question.
Yeah, right.
I mean, I don't think there's any question that they believe that their only chance to success is to suppress turnout. But that if everyone can vote, they will lose. But right. David, isn't that what all the objective evidence is?
Yes, absolutely. I think so. So you mentioned the Honest Election Project, which I've been following. What I want to know more specifically is, besides the Trump campaign, when you're in these litigation battles, you know, who are the bad guys? Talk a little bit about these public interest law firms on the right, like the Public Interest Legal Foundation. They just launched an avoid mail voting campaign. What role do they play? And, you know, so who are you up against?
So we are up against an array of Republican committees. So the Republican National Committee, everyone's heard of, the Republican Senate Committee and the Republican House Committees, they all as well. The Trump campaign, you know, it's interesting. I don't think we've ever seen or certainly not in my lifetime, a presidential campaign be a plaintiff in a lawsuit to restrict voting rights.
Right.
But the Trump campaign itself is actually quite active in court opposing voting rights. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, you then move to a number of right-wing organizations, the Honest Elections Project being the biggest. It appears to be the most well-funded, which isn't totally surprising given their background with the Federalist Society.
Right.
But then you have groups like the Public Interest Legal Foundation, which seems very intent on trying to purge voters and other kinds of things. And then you have a whole bunch of sort of hanger-on or right-wing organizations that sort of pop up in a state here or there, and you just kind of scratch your head. There was a case in Nevada by, I think, an outfit called the Election Integrity Project, affiliated with Sharon Angle. then you wind up with those as well.
One of those names is the opposite of what it means.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. So let's just step back and tell me a little bit about the Democracy Docket, why it was formed, the mission. On your website, you talk about the four pillars when it comes to protecting voting rights. Talk a little bit about what they are and why they're important.
Sure. So I created Democracy Docket for a few reasons. First of all, because I thought it was important that as we saw an increase of litigation, that there was a place on the web that people could go to and find good, accurate information about voting and also accurate information about the litigation that's pending. So we both provide sort of educational information, like how do I vote by mail and that kind of stuff, and also a map where you could look up the laws in your state and also whatever litigation is going on in your state. So that was one reason for creating it. The second, though, was that it became very, very clear, even before the pandemic, that there was not on the left any place, or I shouldn't say there wasn't any place. I thought there was a need for an additional place on the left for people to sort of think through issues of how we approach fair voting. So here's one of the things that motivated me. In 2018, you may remember there was a close election in Florida.
Right.
And
Senator Nelson, right?
Senator Nelson lost by 0.1%. And there was a study by academics of the rejected mail ballots. So these are people who voted by mail, but their ballot didn't count. And what they found is that for voters 18 to 21, the rejection rate was 5.4%. For those over 65, it was 0.6%.
Yeah.
For black and brown, it was north of 2%. For whites, it was under 1%. So what we saw was a very, very different treatment or results for younger voters and black and brown voters than we saw for white and older voters. And so it seemed to me that there needed to be a site and a place where people were talking about these issues and understanding that voting rights is not just about making sure people can register and make sure people can vote, but it's also about making sure their votes can count. And so in the pandemic, on March 17th, I wrote a piece called The Four Pillars to Protect Voting Rights with Vote by Mail, which was sort of the culmination of my thinking about this for several years, in which I said, look, we're going to have a lot of people voting by mail, and we normally have a rejection rate that is about 1 to 1.5% of mail ballots. That rejection rate could go up dramatically with more people voting by mail. And we know that when that happens, it will disproportionately hit African-American, Latinx, and young voters. And so here are the four things that states can adopt now that will mitigate that. We'll sort of take down the rejection rates for everyone and flatten the curve between young and old and black and white. And we published that. It immediately got picked up by Stacey Abrams as the gold standard. It was contained in Kamala Harris's safe voting bill. It was in Nancy Pelosi's HEROES Act, in the Wyden-Klobuchar bill. Those four pillars got you know, sort of adopted. And we started bringing litigation against states around that. Other organizations like the ACLU started bringing lawsuits around the four pillars. And those have become sort of the underpinning of a lot of the litigation you now see between the Democrats and the Republicans and the left and the right.
Right. I see. So you came up with a strategic framework for this, which is a great insight, I think.
Yeah. And that's hopefully what Democracy Doc will do as we move forward around things like redistricting. You know, right. I'm hoping that it again will be a place where we can sort of set some parameters about what do we believe is fair? Right. What do we believe is right?
Right.
Because as you know, David, the right wing has a lot of forums to do that.
Yeah.
You know, they do that through the Federalist Society. They do that through, what is it, ALEC?
Yeah. ALEC? Yes, yeah. ALEC. Exactly.
You know, and the left, you know, around legal principles, we have existing organizations and institutions, but I thought that there was a place for one more.
Yeah, ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. Yeah, one of the things they do are draft these bills, these voter suppression bills that then get sent up. So let's get into the litigation a little bit. My numbers might be slightly out of date because I guess things are popping up all the time, but what I have is so far in the 2020 cycle, you've filed 56 lawsuits in 22 states, all for the purpose of protecting voting rights in November. So what I want to know is a lot of them are vote by mail related. What do you think of these in categories or buckets? And can you tell me what sort of the through lines are?
Yeah, I do. So there are the cases that are the four pillar cases, right? And the four pillars are free postage, because it turns out making voters put postage is a huge barrier for young voters in particular, but voters, but lower income voters. Second is reforming signature match laws so that people's ballots are not thrown out because an untrained worker doesn't think the signatures match from the signature on file, and making sure that if there is signature matching, voters have an opportunity for notice and cure. The third is allowing community organizations to collect and return sealed mail ballots. This is very important for the Native American community, among others. And the last is ensuring that ballots postmarked by Election Day count, even if they're received afterwards, to prevent mail delays from disenfranchising voters. So the first bucket of cases I think of are the four pillars cases, which basically litigate for those four things.
Right.
The second bucket are the in-person voting cases, you know, the cases that deal with how are we going to avoid long lines?
Right.
You know, how are we going to make sure there's enough voting equipment? How do we make sure that in Florida they're not banning voting locations on college campuses?
Right.
You know, those kinds of things.
Right.
The third are some issues that are unique to COVID. You know, there are some issues that have arisen that really are obstacles that voters are running into because of COVID. And then the last, which, you know, we have not seen as much of yet, but, you know, we'll see, are dealing with voter suppression, the traditional forms of what you were asking me about Republican, you know, voter suppression efforts.
Right. I see. Okay. So, you know, I'm on your email list, and you've racked up a number of impressive victories here. So tell me about a couple or more of the significant ones.
Yeah, I'll tell you about two. One which is not really in any of these frames, but which is incredibly meaningful is, and it's not a presidential battleground state, but I feel it's important to mention is, we sued Mississippi over a provision in their state constitution that require that in order to be elected governor, you had to both get the popular vote and a majority of the state legislative districts. This provision was put in the law in the 1890s by a racist constitutional convention that was trying to keep the freed African-American population, which at that point, African-American men outnumbered white men.
Oh.
And the white population was afraid that they would take over the government. So they put in place this electoral college system of sorts that has since then kept an African-American from being elected to statewide office in Mississippi. We challenge that. The state is now in the process of amending their state constitution, and hopefully on November 3rd, all the folks on the who are listening from Mississippi will vote for that change to the constitutional amendment. So I just wanted to mention that as an aside, because it's an example of voting rights litigation that can really make a difference for voters in the long run.
Right.
In terms of this election cycle, you know, we have had a number of successes in Minnesota, in Michigan, in Pennsylvania, North Carolina, over the postmark by receipt deadline.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really important because we know a few things. Number one, we know that even in a neutral environment, there are differences in the way in which mail ballots by young voters versus old and black versus white are treated in terms of timing of delivery. I'm not saying the Postal Service sets out to do that. I'm just saying the reality of it is that you see more ballots rejected for being late delivered from younger voters than older voters and black voters from white voters. So one of the important things about the postmark rule is it levels that playing field, and it's no longer up to the voter knows that if they get it postmarked by election day, it's going to count, even if the Postal Service is a little slower in one area and a little faster in another.
Right, I see.
Obviously, with DeJoy in the Postal Service,
yeah, right.
That's not all things are not necessarily equal.
Yes, right.
So it's even more important now.
Right. So let me just stay on the victories. Just generally speaking. You know, because it's a little hard to keep track reading about all these cases, you know, much less bringing them, I'm sure. How many of the victories are like settled, or how many of them are still on appeal and up in the air? Just generally speaking.
Yeah, great question. So if you go to democracydocket.com, we added in the last week or so a 2020 case count that will actually tell you how many active cases, how many states, and how many cases we have won. So right now, as of this recording, we have 33 active cases in 13 states.
Okay.
Now, will all of those be resolved by election day? Some of those are cases we have won that are now up on appeal.
Right.
Right. So a case that is currently a victory and active could go to become a loss and inactive.
Right.
Right. Or but there are 33 cases right now that are one way or another still in court where there is further court proceedings.
I see. Okay. That gives me a good sense. And so on the flip side, where have you been disappointed?
Yeah. So I'm glad you asked. So, you know, every case we lose, I take personally.
Right.
So, you know, that's just, I think, the nature of the beast. I think that the loss we had a few weeks ago in the South Carolina in the U.S. Supreme Court in the South Carolina case was very disappointing. You had a situation in South Carolina where they require a witness in order to vote an absentee ballot. So in many of these cases, we have been successful in either eliminating or mitigating the burden of the witness requirement. In South Carolina, we undertook an effort to do the same thing there by saying, look, in times of COVID, when, you know, we are told to socially distance, if you're living alone and you're elderly, getting a witness is the difference between being able to vote and not being able to vote.
Right.
So we thought that it was appropriate to mitigate the witness requirement in South Carolina under those circumstances for those kinds of voters. A trial court held a hearing, took evidence, listened to the testimony, and agreed with us. The case went up to the Fourth Circuit. Initially, a three-judge panel on the Fourth Circuit disagreed with us, but then the full Fourth Circuit agreed with us. So the en banc Fourth Circuit agreed with us. It went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court reversed. And I have to say, it's a disappointment to lose any case. Disappointment to lose any case in the Supreme Court. But you know, I think about those voters who now in South Carolina may just not be able to vote. Like, this is a, like, it's all well and good for a court to say, well, they can always vote in person, or they can always find a witness or whatever. But like, the reality of people's lives is that they won't all be able to vote in person, and they won't all be able to find a witness. And so that one, you know, probably sticks with me right now more than the others.
And how did that decision come down? What was the?
It was 5-3. So it was the 5 conservative justices.
Okay. So now I'm going to jump ahead a bit, because I had a question about the courts. And so while we're on it, you know, the voter suppression strategy that we talked about has the first prong, the way I see it, is you've got the elected Republicans who pass the restrictive laws. But the second piece of it, you know, you've got the Honest Election Project, but it's very closely tied into the Judicial Crisis Network. And so the strategy sort of doesn't work unless you've got this court packing thing going on too on their side. So is there a partisan pattern that you discern in the court decisions that are coming down for you?
So I would say this. There is no question that the Trump era has had a profound impact on the composition of the federal courts.
Okay.
We have won some cases before conservative judges. We won a case in Pennsylvania before a Trump-appointed judge. We won a case in Minnesota before a Trump-appointed judge. As you get to the courts of appeals, and certainly to the Supreme Court, there does seem to be, at least so far, but, you know, we'll see. There's a Pennsylvania case pending for the U.S. Supreme Court. There are almost certainly going to, there's a Wisconsin case pending for the U.S. Supreme Court. But, you know, it's there. You'd have to be blind to not acknowledge that the pattern of decisions, not just in the voting arena, by the way, but just across a range of issues, have seemed to hinge more on the party of the president that appointed the judges. And that is lamentable. I mean, that's, you know, it was not always that way.
Right. And so how does the, if you think it does, how does the Amy Coney Barrett nomination factor into the equation here?
So I have not given as much thought to that as I think a lot of other people have. In that, you know, I've been litigating these cases that are all on really, really short terms.
Yeah.
I think there's no question that as you look to post-election, I don't mean post-election as in like election-related litigation, but as you look to the court's docket for the next 12 months, the next 12 years, you know, like as opposed to the next 12 hours. I think there's no question that the court has tilted further to the right than we've ever seen. I mean, you know, I am slightly embarrassed to say I didn't watch much of the hearings, but I did catch pieces of it. And there was an exchange about Griswold versus Connecticut I thought was curious. You know, Griswold versus Connecticut was from 1965, and it dealt with a criminal prosecution of a clinic owner who was dispensing contraception to married women.
Right.
And if that is not a settled precedent, if the right to contraception is not a settled precedent, you can kind of go to Roe, and then before Roe, Griswold, and then the cases before Griswold are like the right to teach your children a foreign language. Like that's literally like the next case in right to privacy.
I see.
Like you go back to the 30s.
Right.
And like I think it's literally was the right to teach children German at home during World War II.
Right.
Like it's, and so you wonder how far back we go before the conservatives will say we've reached settled precedent. So,
right. Yeah. No, that was definitely a striking moment. Just to get a sense of what you've alluded to it, but just now, but what your life is like, are there moving targets right now? Are you playing whack-a-mole? Are there Republicans out there who are still scheming to to find new ways to restrict the access, or is the playing field pretty well set?
You know, every time I think it's set, I wind up playing whack-a-mole. You know, earlier this week, the Republican Party of North Carolina filed a lawsuit in Duplin County, North Carolina, to try to create out of thin air a right to challenge absentee ballots. Didn't see that coming. You know, we intervened. Thankfully, the court rejected it. But, you know, that was a case of whack-a-mole. You know, I know that this podcast won't air the same day, but, you know, today, Friday, the Republican, just before we recorded, the Republican Secretary of State of Florida issued guidance that restricts drop boxes in Florida. I have to say, David,
is that right?
If you had the like voter suppression bingo card of 2020 and you had war on drop boxes, man, you were the big winner. I mean, like, talk about things I didn't see coming.
Right.
You know?
Right.
They'd go hard negative on ballot drop boxes.
Right.
And insist that in the middle of a pandemic, that no, the way you have to return your ballot is by handing it to a person in person or putting it in the mail.
Right. And there's one of those in Texas, right?
Oh, yeah. There. Let us review the bidding. The Ohio Secretary of State limited drop boxes to one per county. One per county.
Right.
Okay. The Republicans sued Pennsylvania to try to ban drop boxes entirely. The Republicans are trying to prevent drop boxes in North Carolina, drop off locations in North Carolina. The Governor Abbott is trying to prohibit not even drop boxes, but just allowing county offices to accept by hand mail ballots.
Right.
Like literally, like people want to hand their ballot to an election official. And he said you can only do that. A county can only allow that in one office per state, per county, one per county.
Uh-huh.
You know, Missouri, wow. They bought drop boxes. They purchased the drop boxes. And then the Republicans said they're not going to deploy them. So if I'm a taxpayer in Missouri, I want to know why my tax money went to buy drop boxes that the Republican right. officials then said they wouldn't deploy.
Right.
So, yeah, it's all over.
Wow. That's crazy. So is there anywhere you think if a voter restriction stays in place, a particular state, that could tip the election?
So I don't think for president, because I think, you know, I think that Vice President Biden is ahead. You know, we have a lot of hard work to do, and everyone needs to vote, and everyone needs to vote early. So I never want to, you know, coast on where we are.
Right.
But, you know, I think that, you know, for it to make a difference in a presidential election, a lot of things have to happen. But remember, we're not just electing a president. We're electing Congress. We're electing senators. We're electing town councils, state legislatures. And these restrictions will affect outcomes of elections. I can't tell you it'll be the presidential election. I can't even tell you it'll be a Senate election.
Sure.
But it will affect the outcome of elections.
Right. Okay. That's what I thought. Let's flash forward. I don't know where we are, 19 days or so. What's election night going to look like for you?
So, I have said for years, in fact, I think I once said this to you, before the 2016 election, that I have said for years that one of the downsides of my job is that I'm always working on election day. So I never get to sit at home and watch election results.
Right.
This year, I would not have – this isn't the way I kind of anticipated it, but this year I will be at home, though I'll still be working.
Yeah.
But, you know, it will not be a typical election day in that I will not be congregating with clients as I usually am, congregating at campaigns.
Right.
So, you know, I'll be working remotely, but I will have a, you know, a full communication set up so that we are able to, you know, able to fully monitor and participate in whatever needs to happen.
Right. So
it'll be weird, don't you think?
Yeah, definitely. Right. No, it'll definitely be strange. I mean, the last one I watched alone was when the Supreme Court came down in Bush v. Gore.
Yeah.
Because I think that was the middle of the night. But
yeah. But I mean, but think about, you know, like the iconic image of 2008 and all of those people packed tightly.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, it's just hard to imagine what how it's going to feel this time with all of the, you know, with all of the social distancing.
Right. Yeah. So you're involved with the Biden special litigation unit, I think, that is going to take the fight, if necessary, beyond election night. So without saying anything you can't, what can you say about, you know, the readiness of campaign or your group to deal with whatever controversies might ensue after election night?
Yeah. So what I can say is that they're incredibly well prepared. You know, this is an outfit that has a lot of experienced lawyers around it. You know, Bob Bauer, who is very senior in the Biden campaign, has been, you know, one of the founders of the area of political law and a very, very experienced lawyer in this arena. Dana Remus, the general counsel, is wicked smart and on top of all of this. And, you know, and the team of lawyers across the board that they've assembled for pieces of this are extremely thoughtful and experienced. You know, my role, as you know, probably not surprising, is more on the casting and counting side, given my past experience doing recount work.
Right.
But I think people should feel confident that the Biden campaign is ready to go, as are the Senate campaigns, the House campaigns. You know, I think the Democratic Party, if you look since the 2000 election, and you just look at close elections, you know, I think you'd see that there were real lessons learned after 2000 and that, you know, by the way, not that the effort in 2000 was the fault of the Democrats. It was a Supreme Court 5-4 decision that shut down the recount. Right. But I think you've seen, you know, that that, you know, the party's been prepared. And I expect that in 2020.
Great. So one of the things about the aftermath of the election that is a little maybe troubling is that the polls show Republican confidence in the outcome of the election is well below 50%. And Republicans are four times likely as Democrats to say voter fraud is a major issue. Of course, that's an issue that they've, you know, concocted over the years, but it's held widely now by Republicans. So assuming Biden wins, you know, where does that leave us? And I guess I have to say, on the flip side, if Trump wins, you know, a lot of Democrats may be convinced he stole it, given the corrupt campaign against the Postal Service and mail-in voting. So where does all this leave us?
So, you know, I think that one of the challenges that we have and have had for some time as a country is combating right-wing misinformation or disinformation. This will sound familiar to you, David, since Media Matters, I think, is the premier organization. It's the place I go to when I want to understand what is going on. It's very difficult to understand exactly how much misinformation is going on the right.
Yeah.
And I wish I could tell you what the answer to it would be post-election, but I'm just going to assume that, you know, a party that right now won't denounce QAnon is going to have available to it an echo chamber around a narrative of election results that is just going to be immune from facts and from reason.
Yeah.
So I don't know what the way out of that is.
Right.
I wish I did, but I don't. And actually, I turn to people like you to tell people like me what the way out of that is.
Right. It's going to be a reality because they'll create their own reality. And that is a very difficult thing to pierce. And that may just be something we live with.
I mean, the question I have is, does the Republican Party at that point sort of snap out of its bad nightmare?
Right. Well, that's the big question.
Or does it go deeper into it?
Right. Right. My guess is it goes deeper in, but
yeah. I think that's probably right.
But I think they have to lose several elections to come out of it, to snap out of it. And hopefully that's what will happen. So I have one last question. Once the dust has settled after the election, what are the kinds of reforms we need to change the voting laws to make elections fair and more honest, and how are we going to get there?
Yeah, so I think that one of the things that Donald Trump has taught us is that we can no longer assume that our democracy laws around democratic institutions can simply rely on good faith and fair dealing, and that we're going to need laws that are much clearer in restricting the powers of elected officials and election officials and political parties or whatever actors to make sure that they're doing the right thing and not simply count on the public shaming or the public pressure for folks to do the right thing. So I think, among other things, you know, there's a lot of talk about reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act, and obviously reauthorizing Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act is an important piece of it. But I think we need to go much further than that.
Right.
I think we need to affirmatively I think Congress needs to affirmatively enact legislation that defines a federal right to vote that is not subject to judicial weighing in the way in which it currently is. Yeah. Right now, in each of these cases, judges are saying, well, yeah, this has this burden on the right to vote, but on the other side, you have these other factors. I think Congress needs to say unequivocally that in federal elections, which is its right under the Constitution to do, in federal elections, there is a federal right to vote, and that right to vote is paramount above the inconvenience to the state, above the administrative burden to the state. That is that the first, second, and third priority of states and the federal courts and state courts are to protect voting rights. And so there, I'll have a lot more to say about this. I'm actually working on some projects for Democracy Docket and potentially longer form outside of Democracy Docket where I'll lay this out. But I think it's going to have to be a top priority.
Yeah, great. Well, thanks for fighting this fight. It's so important. And thanks for doing this. I think we can wrap it up now.
Thank you, David. It's okay. A pleasure. And you know, I feel like you and I have been in the trenches fighting side by side, and hopefully that'll continue.
Yes, absolutely. Well, you know, regardless of the result, we're not giving up. So thank
you.
That's exactly right. Right.
And you know, I say this and you know, you'll probably edit this out, but you know, after 2016, I was about ready to give up. I think a lot of us were about ready to give up.
Oh yeah, I had a period.
And Hillary Clinton told us not to.
Right.
I really, I think that her ability every day to wake up and face a torrent of lies and disinformation every day is part of what led me, at least, to have the strength to every day fight these fights. So,
yeah, I've often thought about her resilience in the same context. Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks. Mark, this has been a great and enlightening conversation. Thanks so much for joining us today, and keep fighting for free, fair, and honest elections. For more information on American Bridge, please visit AmericanBridgePact.org. Check back for more podcasts and information about the upcoming election and how we plan to hold Republicans accountable. Until next time, I'm David Brock. Thanks for listening to The War Room at American Bridge.